backed into it.
Thank you, Rose. Ladies and gentlemen, comrades and friends, it's always a great pleasure for me to come to St. Paul, Minneapolis. I say St. Paul, Minneapolis, I guess you'd shorthand it by saying the Twin Cities. Although it has been now at least 10 years since I've had the opportunity of addressing the group here, I have maintained relationships with at least the leadership of your area throughout these years. This morning, while Ralph, Rose, and I were sitting down talking about some of the problems here, without them knowing it, my mind traveled back through the years and I started to ask myself, where is this particular person who was a leader when I was young before? Where is that particular person who was a leader when I was young before? Well, many of them have fled as time has gone by. And as I sat there, I thought that these are the real heroes. Those of you who are holding together during this period in which we have endured some of the greatest blows that have ever been leveled on an organized force of people in the history of our country. And those of you who have maintained the faith, have stood fast, steadfast together, have in many instances been isolated, in some instances ostracized, in other instances job reprisals, in some instances some of your friends deported, and countless others who have gone to jail for the things that have binded us together through the years, and you in so doing have laid the foundation for a brighter tomorrow. I come here today before you with a feeling of optimism about the future. I come here today before you with a feeling that the worst is behind us, and that objectively speaking, the possibilities are maturing for a change in what we have been witnessing for the last 17 years in our country. Now, I do not base this optimism upon any wishful thinking. Of course, we would all desire things to be much better than they are. But I base it upon what has occurred in other previous periods in history, and that is, after having gone through a certain period, one can see signs which indicate that you have reached a turning point and you are about to travel on a new highway. And that's about how I see things now, following what historians will one day refer to, no doubt, the Cuban crisis as the greatest crisis in all the history of mankind. Having successfully weathered that great crisis, I think that the doors are now being opened up for new opportunities, new approaches, new advances, new movements, new people, all dedicated to bring about and make of this period what one historian now refers to it as, no longer the age of frustration, but the age of change. And this is the chief characteristic that I think will follow the events in Cuba. This will usher in a new period, an age of change, where things will not be what they were like yesterday. Now, let me say that the Cuban crisis has certainly been weathered, and the overall positive achievement of that crisis was the very fact that we're still here. Because what was at stake during this crisis was a world atomic war. That was what is at stake. Not only the invasion of Cuba, but a world atomic war, which some have calculated in 24 hours would have resulted in 150 million people and at least a third or a half of the world inhabitable because of the damage that would have been done by atomic bombs. This was what was at stake, and this was what was averted. And if all other things are equal, this was necessarily the most positive thing, and I think all who have common sense will agree that this was the case. The second thing that was of decisive importance was the fact that the Cuban people still are free to build a socialist island down in the Caribbean. Now, it may well be that the reactionaries in America are still working overtime to cancel out that result, but the facts are that it will be more difficult now, as a result of what did take place, to cancel out those results than it was prior to that development. So I would say that that is a second major positive factor. A third major factor was that possibilities of winning the peace for the world for an indefinite period of time has also been enhanced. About this, I'll have much more to say, but at this time, I want to go off the positive into the negative, because I'm certain that on the minds of some of you, your minds may be focusing on some of the negative results. They are very serious, but not necessarily decisive in making an estimate of what came as a result of this crisis. I refer here to the split in the world communist movement. With the emergence of two centers, two gravitas within the world communist movement. On the one hand, parties of the 81 parties which signed the Declaration of Peace several years ago, headed by the Soviet Union, on the one hand, and several of the parties gravitating more toward Peking, the Chinese Communist Party, and a struggle, a sharp struggle, which has been going on for some time, came into sharper focus as a result of the Cuban crisis, and now continues under conditions that I am certain bring chills to the backs of most of us when we see and read some of the literature that comes forth as a result of this great battle going on. This is one of the negative features flowing from the Cuban situation. In a certain sense, it existed before, but as a result of the Cuban crisis, these problems became aggravated, and up until now, a split has occurred in the world communist movement. Now, this may surprise all of us, and yet we shouldn't be surprised, because throughout the history of Marxism, there has always been a struggle against certain tendencies within the working class movement. This is nothing new. When Karl Marx lived during his time, and they founded the International Working Men's Association, there was continuous struggles being waged within that organization between some that was known at that time as Bakunist, anarchist, some on the other side, Lassallians, who would say tended more to the right, left and right tendencies, always have been manifested in the Marxist working class movement. Struggles during those days resulted sometimes in splits and formations of other organizations and so forth of the working class. While these are organizations and individuals were united on the ultimate goal, they disagreed fundamentally on the methods to which the goal was to be achieved. And methods are as important as the goal, because wrong methods negate the possibility of the achievement of a goal, and hence the struggle must be waged as rigorously for the proper methods and approaches to the problems of achieving what all generally agree upon as a goal. And so they fought in those days. Karl Marx fought, Engels fought, against what was known as opportunism. Opportunism being what we call the surrender of the ultimate goal for some immediate relief, which is in opposition to the ultimate goal, be it from the left or from the right. Then came the Second International, formed near the close of the 18th century. This organization, too, later on became shipwrecked on the basis of struggles between various contending forces within the organization on the basis of what should have been the policy in respect to a whole host of questions that were plaguing the party and the people's movements of those periods. Out of this struggle came the Third International, the Communist International, with the birth of the Russian Revolution. So in all three of these international working class organizations, there have been periods of splits, there have been periods of sharp struggles between contending forces. So I mentioned this background in order to indicate that we shouldn't be surprised that it still continues. The difficulty in comprehending it today is it's far more dangerous to have these splits under today's conditions than they were 50 years ago. Because today it is no longer a problem of communist parties. Today it is a problem of communist parties leading nations. And with it, nations go into struggle. It becomes a struggle between whole peoples. And this gives it a certain, a certain feature that was not present in previous struggles and makes it all the more difficult. And more importantly, this struggle comes at a time when the world communist movement is on the upgrade. One third of the world has taken the path toward communism, toward socialism. And at a time when imperialism is very weak, at a time when if the world communist movement is united, then the possibility of sounding the death knell of capitalism is much more assured, more quickly, let's put it that way. And so for these reasons, these struggles that are taking place are painful, painful. Now, I have assumed that maybe some of you read some of the literature and so forth. What must be the criteria of American Marxist for judging the issues that are involved in order to be able to take a stand as to where do we stand in respect to these struggles that are taking place on a global scale as well as in our own country? What is involved in this struggle is an estimate of the world of today. A correct estimate can be very fruitful in terms of advancing the struggle. An incorrect estimate can be very harmful in terms of advancing the struggle. What are some of the estimates now that are at issue? First of all, let me say that the problem is not one of dictating by one party or to another party what its internal policy should be in respect to its own country. For example, we do know that the Chinese Communist Party initiated a system called communes several years ago. It was the thinking of most Marxists and partisans and so forth that they were rushing history too fast, that the country was not yet ready for this high form of collective effort, and that it wouldn't succeed. But nobody would argue with the Chinese that this was their own business. Their internal development was their own business. Perhaps on many other questions, many may have had differences of opinion, but no debate was developed on these kind of questions. The debate takes place on those kind of problems that transcends one's own country. Problems which impinge upon the world as a whole, and problems in which everybody's involved. Not only one party and one country, But the world as such is involved in the outcome of that discussion and the outcome of the debate that takes place. Now, what is the central question at issue here? The central question at issue here is, how do we destroy imperialism? How is imperialism to be destroyed? Well, the Chinese communists say, by the armed strength of the masses. By the armed masses. They contradict themselves, because having said the armed strength of the masses on the one hand, then in the next breath they say, do not be intimidated by atomic weapons and so forth, because the people are decisive. What this position is a position that does not take into account the new features in today's world. One might have spoken 25 or 50 years ago about turning imperialist wars into civil wars, which was what was done in the Russian Revolution. One might have spoken very easily and very freely, as did Stalin in 1938, when he warned the world bourgeoisie, who were at that time preparing to go to war. And I quote him, "The bourgeoisie seeks their way out of the crisis through war. But if they launch a war, they will find that out of that war, they will lose some of their kingdoms, which they now rule over so happily by grace of the eternal God," unquote. One could speak with a certain absolute certainty that comes a war, forces will accumulate which will destroy capitalism in a certain way. And this was what followed the two world wars. World War number one gave us what? The Russian Revolution. It brought about the formation of the freedom of oppressed nations inside of Europe, like the Czechs, who were oppressed in the old Austro-Hungarian Empire. The Irish gained freedom. The Turks gained freedom. And the freedom movement in the colonies assumed a certain new higher level following World War number one. And the working class movement the world over became stronger coming out of that war. That is World War One. World War Two was an even greater tempo of freedom arising out of a war. Take, for example, the fact today 45 nations have been freed from imperialism since the end of World War Two. The socialist world, which up until World War II was only in the Soviet Union, I don't remember what this used to say that was, one-sixth of the world. One-sixth of the world. Today, socialism is being built in one-third of the world. These certainly are developments that followed World War II. But, comrades, we are in a period in which new weaponry in the pursuit of war places new problems before the peoples of the world, and problems cannot be resolved in the same way as they were in World War One and World War Two. They just cannot be. When people make irresponsible statements to the effect that World War III will result only in the destruction of the capitalist system, one wonders what kind of a world does one live in. Or statements to the effect that we could lose 500 million Chinese and still have 200 million left to go out and reorganize the world. The existence of atomic weaponry with the capacity to do what I've already spoken about introduces a new feature in world politics which must be taken into account by any serious-minded forces that want to change the world of today. Now, I'm going to say something here. If I were given a choice today, I have devoted 31 years of my life in the pursuit of socialism. If I were to be given a choice today to say that you could have socialism in the United States tomorrow, but we would have to shed the lives of about 20 or 25 million Americans, and to say that if you don't do it that way and you choose another method, that it will take at least 10 more years to do it. I personally would choose 10 more years rather than to think in terms of losing 15 or 20 million people. For I ask of you, what are we fighting for? We're fighting for the people. Socialism is an instrument for what purpose? For the betterment of a lot of mankind. And I cannot see how mankind will be much better off losing 20 million people. All right, you can say that sometimes the few for the many, like the Battle of Stalingrad, where a couple of 100,000 troops are sacrificed in order to save the whole Soviet Union. Surely that was a necessary military tactic. One speaks of that in a different light. To speak in terms so glibly that you just wipe off so many people, well, this is not in keeping with my concept of socialism and communism as humanism, as based upon people. As Stalin once said, the greatest capital in the world is people. See? And this is what we're fighting for, to make a better life for all the people. And to speak glibly about, one wonders if one hasn't become mechanized with cliches and systems independently of people, that people become pawns in this great chessboard of history. And so, the big question before us today is the question of perspective in respect to how to bring about the destruction of imperialism, how to bring about a socialist world. Well, there are two approaches to this problem. Our Chinese comrades have taken the viewpoint that this is achievable only through the armed struggle of the masses. Those who do not share the Chinese communist position on this question take the viewpoint that has been developed by the Soviet Union's party and their approach to this problem. What is that approach? Struggling, yes, against imperialism, supporting just wars of liberation of colonists from imperialism, but avoiding as many situations as you possibly can which would catapult World War III into existence. And placing reliance on socialism demonstrating its superiority in life over capitalism. What do we mean by that? It means that when the socialist world, and more particularly the Soviet Union, which is the most advanced sector of the socialist world, demonstrates to the American working class that their system can bring more benefits to the average working man than capitalism is able to give, we believe that then the condition will be ripe for them to make a change of this system based on their own experience and not what we project as what will be, but based on their actual experience. I had the good fortune back in the early 30s to go to the Soviet Union. And on the ship of going across, there were about 200 American educators, professors from some of the leading universities in the country and so forth. And every day on that ship, the conversation was the Soviet Union. What's happening over there? This great experiment. Is it true that they've solved the problem of unemployment? What is their social system? Is it true that there is free medical aid for those who need it? Is it true that they have a higher degree of educational system than we have in the West? All of these questions came to the fore, and the debate went back and forth among all these people as they were going across. I likened it at the time and said, there was a time when America occupied first place in the affection of the world and the attention of the world. When those who came to these shores seeking a haven from oppression the world over, America was a mecca, a meeting place. Everybody in Europe wanted to come to America and so forth. America was the country that was looked forward to as the example of how mankind should march forward. And now the Soviet Union had taken that place of people going there. There is where the future lies in the development of socialism in the Soviet Union. All of this was manifest. But you see, the Soviet Union, in my judgment, this interest that was manifested in the early 30s, if without World War II intervening, would have long ago proven that the socialist system is superior to the capitalist system. But it has not yet proven conclusively enough that this is the case. Because the Soviet Union was set back. I don't know how many tens of millions of people were killed. Some of the finest and most talented skill of the country was killed. Hundreds of thousands of factories and homes and things that had been built in the first and second, third, 5-year plan destroyed. Whole cities devastated. And while on the one hand, socialism, which was beginning to emerge and beginning to prove its capacity for affecting a better life for its people and so forth, was set back. United States imperialism becoming the banker and the supplier of nations in World War II became richer in the course of World War II. Our country became richer. New plants were opened up by the hundreds. Mass production techniques were developed in many directions. We didn't lose one factory. We didn't lose one house. And as a consequence of World War II in the favorite position that America occupied, American capitalism emerged out of World War II with a great fanfare of accomplishments. And the standard of living, relatively speaking, of the American working class went tremendously higher. I felt at the time of World War II, when some 10 or 12 million Americans went abroad and looked at the backward techniques of British industry, admired somewhat the advanced techniques of German industry, but took a look at the poverty of the world and came back to America and said, thank God for America, for American capitalism, what have you, that we have the best system in the world. Millions and millions and millions of dollars were poured into propaganda, into the factories, mills, mines, and workshops, all during this post-war period, to prove the superiority of American capitalism by measuring how many washing machines are in the average home, how many TV sets, how many workers have automobiles, contrasted to how many people ride bicycles in Europe, with a consequence that a certain self-satisfaction did set in And this is one of the reasons why it has been exceedingly difficult during this period to develop a widespread socialist movement. It was easier in the 30s and in the 40s, and we were on our way. But this new situation arising out of World War II was a factor in terms of creating illusions that American capitalism was superior. What can socialism give me? I got my socialism. I got my car. I got all the gadgets in the house. My wife doesn't have to worry too much about, you know, just throw those things over there and turn on the electricity. All of the gadgets. This is socialism. And what are you talking about, socialism? Well, what do they got over there where they got it? You got exactly nowhere. So it became difficult during this period for this example to break through, because superficially speaking, the example was here. Well, it is now the shoes begin to go on the other foot. The Soviet Union today is working on a 12-year plan. And that 12-year plan calls for surpassing America in the production of most of the vital things that are needed by their people. And they say, we don't need to export no revolution. We don't need no World War III to bring socialism into the world. If and when we prove by our example that socialism can put more bread into the mouths of people than any other system, the people themselves will sign the death knell to that given system. That's the approach that has been developed there. Now, comrades and friends, this approach is already beginning to bear some fruits. The whole world now knows that America has no monopoly no longer on science. In some branches of science, we still may be more skillful, more learned. But outer space and all that is needed to go into that in terms of scientific calculation has proven that the Soviet Union is one of the foremost nations of the world in scientific research. The world knows that socialism has given it. But the capitalist world says, you see, the reason they got Sputniks up first, the reason they are ahead of us in the exploration of outer space is, it costs money to do these things. They spend all their money to do that and starve their people. They are ill-housed, ill-clothed, and ill-fed. We're going to feed our people, we're going to have them well-clothed and well-housed, and going up the sky too. Then we turn around and see that the Soviet system of education is superior. And by the way, this is not Claude Lightfoot speaking. This is the American State Department, just a few years ago, had to admit, because people began to ask questions when the Sputnik went up. How? What? What happens here? How come? And so some of the educators rushed over there to find out what they're doing. And they came back with big tales about 100,000 engineers being turned out every year, and all the character, the curriculum in the schools from a child on up, and they had to say they got a superior educational system than we got. Ah, but you still don't eat as much as we eat. They don't have as many beefsteaks. So what the Soviet Union is saying today is, we're going to give you more beefsteaks, see? And we're going to have better clothes, and we're going to have better housing, and we're going to have better recreation, and we're going to have better security for everybody. And that's our goal, this is what we're aiming at, this is what we're working for. And they are making progress. I just noticed in the paper the other day that for the first time now, the Soviet Union surpassed the United States in the production of steel. And steel is the most basic of all industries. This doesn't mean that they have caught up with the United States in terms of capacity to produce steel. it means that the production that they're turning out is greater. The United States still has greater capacity, but it's unused capacity. It's unused. And so here are two approaches to the question of sounding the death knell to capitalism and so forth. The Soviet Union, the Bolshevik Party, takes the view that our example will have to be the key method for the masses of the world, whilst aiding, yes, the colonial liberation movements, while aiding, yes, the working class in various countries and so forth. But at the same time, our basic method is not going to be one of catapulting the world into World War III with 100 million casualties, and then from that point on, talk about building up a socialist system. So this is one of the key methods, key things that are at stake in this debate that is taking place now. Secondly, it was developed at the 20th Congress, the question of peaceful path to socialism in a whole number of countries. You say it was guaranteed. But Marxists should strive to bring about a peaceful path to socialism. The enemy, ruling class, may resort to terror, may resort to fascism, and it may not be possible in some situations. But this is not what we strive for. We strive for a peaceful solution to this problem. And this is what was developed at the 20th Congress. This is what is negated by the Chinese Party's position on these questions. Now, comrades and friends, all of these differences came to the front at the time of the Cuban crisis. Let me speak about that a few minutes, and I'll go into the positive side of this thing, why I feel, at least, that we are approaching a renaissance. Here was the situation in Cuba. Cuba had been invaded just about a year ago. And the Soviet Union, as well as the socialist countries, were helping the Cubans to develop their capacity to defend that island. And in the course of developing it, missiles were placed in certain installations which would have been capable, had they remained there, which would have been capable to have drowned in the sea an armada on its way to attack that island. American policymakers viewed this situation and became desperate. Desperate. Let me use the word desperate. And became determined to wipe it out. They were ready to calculate World War III. But there was a division in these forces, and it's important to see this division. I want to emphasize this. There was a division of opinion in the top councils of the American government. And it's important to see that, which our Chinese brothers do not. They claim that the Kennedy administration is a fascist administration. And they cry about the persecution of poor American communists. Well, I'm glad that somebody is concerned about our persecution. Well, but don't use our persecution as an excuse to overstate the situation that exists. So the Kennedy administration is a fascist administration. Imperialist, of course it's imperialist. But a fascist. Worse than Eisenhower. All one has to do is go read the State of the Union speech, the inaugural address of Kennedy, and then read Eisenhower's two speeches and Truman's. And you'll see a big difference gradually in all of them. Not because of the individuals involved, but the situation was changing. Just read them. Some of us went over them the other day, and it was amazing to see the changes. Containment of communism, massive retaliation, liberation of the of what the these so-called satellites in Europe. Such language is gone now. They got enough occupation in Cuba. Not to talk about Europe anymore. So what happened? They claim that this administration is a fascist administration. Now, I don't want to stand here and hold no brief for an imperialist. Kennedy is an imperialist, he's a capitalist, and he's dedicated to save this system for capitalism. But there are differences between them on methods, too. If we have disagreements on methods, they too have disagreements, sometimes worse. What are some of their disagreements? One school of thought says that we are confident that in the long run, we can win this argument. We can win this argument as to which system is the best system. There's another group which says we can't win it. We can't win it. Can't win it. There's, and it's just like, I don't know how many of you ever read Jack London's book, The Iron Heel, but Jack London appeared before some big capitalist group to talk about the working class struggle, socialism, and so forth, and all these capitalists were trying to argue with him. So one wise old lawyer got up there and told him, he said, "Gentlemen of my class, I'm ashamed of you. What are you doing arguing with him? You can't argue with him. He's got the best of the argument. You got only one answer, Diane Hill." That's where the book got its name from. You got only one argument, Diane Hill. In other words, you arguing with him, you hit him on top of the head. That's the only argument you can get. See? And there are some capitalists in America who come to the conclusion that all this talk about negotiation, all this talk about, well, in the long view, we're going to increase the rate of production in America. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. Now, oh, that's for the birds. Because the only way to get that guy is to hit him. And so they argued for what in Cuba? It was two policies that clashed. When the Cuban crisis emerged, it could have been far different, depending upon who was in the, you know, power in Washington. It could have been far different. For the following reasons. First, there was argument not to put a blockade up, but to invade. That was the position taken by some people. Blockade me? Invade. Without discussion, invade. And what would an invasion meant? Invasion would have meant very little opportunity to do in the discussing, because you're at war now. The Kennedy brothers, together with Stevenson and a few others, took the view, let's put the blockade up first, and from that point, see if we can negotiate. Now, both of them are aimed at throttling Cuba, both positions. But you have a choice between these two positions as to what you choose, if you have nothing better. And so, the very fact that the blockade was placed first was in itself a defeat for the most reactionary elements in American policymaking. That's what it meant. And secondly, it opened up the door for the possibility to negotiate the darn thing. And thirdly, it indicated that there were people there whom you could negotiate with. Because there was a compromise on both sides. This was not a one-way street. This was not a one-way street. There was a compromise on both sides. And my view is that the people got the best of that compromise. That's why you see these reactionaries still yelling. Cuba's on the headlines still of our newspapers, because they realized that when they didn't invade, and when they made a deal, and when they said they would guarantee no invasion and so forth against the Cuban people's government and so forth, that they still building socialism down there. See? And they don't like that. So from my viewpoint, the people won. If it averted World War III and if and which they're doing, Castro's government still exists, and believe me, with all the power we may have as a world Marxist movement, there is no power on earth, short of a World War III, that it would have been possible to save Cuba from annihilation. Those 6 million people would have gone down into the Caribbean just as sure as day follows night. That's what would have happened. They could blow that little island up in 5 minutes. If we talk about blowing up whole nations, half of continents, and so forth and so on. So these are two factors here. But why did the Chinese comrades view this question as a Munich, as appeasement, and accuse the Soviet leadership of being soft on imperialism? Appeasers, Munich, they cried. And this is what brought it to focus, no longer just a polemic internally and so forth, but this brought into focus the question of all the differences and the estimates and so forth. And it was impossible to contain them any longer. They had to be fought out. They still must be fought out. We're fighting them with the viewpoint of eventually uniting this movement, not the splitting of it. But it has to be united on the basis of a correct policy. Because an incorrect policy can be devastating, more devastating than the disunity we may have. I would submit that were we to have had unity on the basis of the Chinese comrades' position, the world would have been darker today. All light would have been vanished, perhaps. And so, comrades and friends, we take our stand, or we should, on the basis of how these things affect us. And we live right here in the heartland of the atomic wavelengths of the world. Now, it's all right for those down in Africa and somewhere in the South Sea Islands, isolated, remote parts of the world and so forth. But we're right here, and we can see what the fruits of these policies could be. And we're concerned because it represents the life and death of our people. And as such, we have a stake in the outcome of these discussions. Now, finally, and I'll be through, an aspect of the Cuban crisis that I think has been given very little attention is the fact that a new condition has been created for not necessarily resolving the differences of the Cold War, but making it now increasingly more difficult for the imperialists to continue the same kind of Cold War that they waged previously. Therein lies the possibility of making of this new period we are entering into the most meaningful period that we have seen in a long, long time. What is this based on? This is based on, first, primarily, that the Cuban crisis, among other things, destroyed the ideological prop upon which American imperialism had predicated its whole position of the Cold War. America surrounded the Soviet Union with bases immediately after World War II. Surrounded it with air alerts 24 hours a day, armed with atomic bombs. This was not, what is it, Cuba, 90 miles from our shores, but 30 miles all around the periphery. And the world looked at it, all but the American policymakers said, this is necessary because the Russians are the menace to peace. They want war. We want peace. And we have contained them with all of these basis for the purpose of attaining peace. We are peace-like, and they're warlike. The American people have been sold a bill of goods that their insecurity that they feel is a result of the Russian menace. And one day, the world got a picture of who really wanted peace and who wanted war in Cuba. And it wasn't a bellicose Khrushchev. It was Khrushchev who saved the peace of the world by being very level-headed and by his willingness to compromise. By his initiation of the compromise. The compromise wasn't initiated from Washington. It was initiated first from the UN and accepted by the Soviet Union, which made it possible to come out of the Cuban crisis unscathed. The world got a new image. Now I sit amazed as I listen to President Kennedy tell us that the Russians don't want war. And that is what he's been telling you now for the past several months on TV interviews, that they want peace. And he writes a letter to Khrushchev. I guess you and I, who have the responsibility, can understand this and appreciate this responsibility better than some others who don't. What has happened here? You see, the American people in the peace movement could be held back as long as they were able to say the problem of peace does not rest with American policy, it rests with Russian policy. There's nothing Americans can do about Russian policy except to arm to the teeth and to confront them militarily. That argument now is gone. They'll never be able to use that again. And it's been a very potent one, very potent. So that one of the ideological props of the Cold War has been removed. Secondly, and I think we must point this out even more so, we now face the danger of an even greater danger emanating again from France and West Germany. Stalin pointed this out at the 19th Party Congress. The main contradictions in the world may seemingly be between capitalism and socialism, but imperialist contradictions among themselves at a given moment can transcend contradictions between the systems of socialism and capitalism. And what have we witnessed in the aftermath of the Cuban crisis? A split in the NATO forces with France and West Germany united together against, yes, Britain and the United States. Now, we don't take ordinarily you say you utilize the contradictions between your enemy. But at the present moment, France and Germany represents a greater danger. And that's one of the reasons why it's very difficult to get an agreement on ending these tests. Very difficult. A Soviet Union is not going to agree to end tests when America can still have tests carried on by France as on the side somewhere. But what has happened here again is what happened in between the two world wars. Who made West Germany so potent? Who built up West Germany from a war-torn country to the first economy outside of the Soviet Union in Europe today? Who's been doing it? Who's been pulling it in there? America. And now it turns to plague us. And so, another one of the aftermaths of the Cuban crisis is a split in the ranks of the imperialist bourgeoisie. And this at the present moment is a matter of world concern. Now, a new enemy emerging, the ideological props taken out from under the Cold War theories of the Soviet menace to peace, the increasing possibility that we will have to live and coexist for a longer period of time is bringing into sharp focus the other aspect of the struggle in a non-military aspect. The aspect of the struggle that continues between the capitalist and socialist world as to which system can be the best system for the people brings to the forefront domestic questions that have to be solved and de-emphasizes the boogeyman. In other words, all your ills are caused by communism. All your problems are caused by communism. You can't pick up radio, TV, and so forth, 1 hour after another. Communism, communism, communism. Every commentator you pick up, communism. Well, it's not falling on the same ears that it fell yesterday. This is the new feature of the situation. And a good example of this was what followed immediately by Mrs. Dagmar Wilson and the Women Win for March of Women for Peace when they went before the House Un-American Committee. When this woman said, "We were welcome, yes, even communists here, because how can you have peace without communists? You can't win the peace without communists. You can't ignore the existence. They're there." This was a new approach. And we find, generally speaking, that red baiting is not bringing the same premiums that it brought several years ago. And we find that attention is now being focused upon problems that didn't exist in the same degree and gravity that existed, didn't exist several years ago, that exists now. American working class today is an insecure working class. No longer the chesty, cocky class which had been told that our American way, our capitalist system, our free enterprise is so superior. Look what you got with all the installment buying. Facing and yet at the same time that we have peak production, we have an army of unemployed increasingly growing, and there is no sign of relief yet in sight. Automation in industry is wiping out jobs of the workers with no placement in sight. The problem of unemployment has become a major problem in the midst of an unprecedented production capacity. See? This is unusual. This is unique. And it's growing like a cancerous sore on the body. We are going to compete with the Soviet Union on economically who can best produce for its people, and automation is eating at our very vitals, and there are many, many automated processes that we can't even utilize, but the Soviet Union, based on its socialist system, can utilize all of them and will have no unemployment. And as time goes on, these problems become manifest. People will want to know how and why this is so. And they will begin to ask for some changes. It is my judgment that if this Kennedy administration or whatever administration is in Washington doesn't come up with some very radical changes in the situation is going to get out of hand, just as it did under Hoover in the 30s. The radical changes that will have to be forthcoming now will transcend everything that was done under the New Deal of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The situation will require it. One of the things that is going to be required is a nationalization of some of these industries. Now, that will be something. That will be the day when one can talk about taking the railroads over and government operated. And when one can talk about taking over these mines where you got all of these, depressed areas. One can say that they're going to have to take some curbs on free enterprise. That free enterprise is not going to be able to have to do unrestrained all of the things that they have done so far in the past in the name of liberty. like, for example, in Chicago, the meatpacking industry overnight decides, well, in the name of profit, we will just move our operation out of Chicago down to Des Moines, Iowa, Sioux City, and Omaha, and so forth. And this big stockyard plant here, which employs some 30,000 people, go out of existence overnight. And 30,000 people go on the market.
With nothing.
Big business could do that. But supposing there's a law which says you can't do that unless you do A, B, C, D, E, F, which lays some guarantees for people. This is the kind of an approach that's going to have to be made. They can't run the shops out of the north into the south the way they've done in the past. What I'm trying to indicate here, what is required, is a radical change, a radical program, transcending any and everything that was done by the New Deal of Franklin and Roosevelt to even get a palliative relief in the midst of this situation. Just for that. And to the extent that there's procrastination in carrying through these reforms, to that extent also will the crisis deepen. Hence, I am of the opinion that we are going into this decade of the 60s into some of the sharpest struggles with advanced demands that would have not been possible to have dreamed of in the decade of the 50s. On the road to Negro freedom, in the decade of the 60s, there must be a basic and fundamental change in the status of the American Negro. This is a must. You can't carry on this competition, now this peaceful coexistence and peaceful competition. And if you don't have a world war in the next 10 or 15 years, this is what it's going to be anyway. With any prospect of winning this battle for capitalism, unless capitalism ameliorates itself so strongly, that maybe people will say, well, all right, the socialist system is all right, but we're making some changes on the capitalism too. And this is one that will have to be met. And I think there are accumulating forces in the United States who are cognizant of that fact. I was amazed at what took place in Chicago in the Christian Conference on Civil Rights a few weeks ago. People representing 110 million American Christians, not only Christians, but Jews too, assembled together and made the most forthright declaration of intent in respect to the question of civil rights than I think that has been made since the abolitionist days of the Civil War and Reconstruction. These people said in a declaration, segregation is a sin against God. We beg forgiveness of God. They can beg all they want to for God. That's all right. But what got me was the next passage. We ask the forgiveness of our brothers against whom we have sinned. And we declare our intention to live no longer at peace with a system of segregation in America. This was important. Reflecting thereby a change that is taking place within the church movement of America, faced as it is with contradictions between its protestations about morality and its inaction in the face of some of the most bestial, murderous, and immoral acts that are perpetrated, like in old Mississippi. The church faced a moral crisis, and its unwillingness to meet this crisis would have meant that the church as an institution would lose favor, no question about it. And they weren't recognized it enough to come to the fore with this kind of a program. Incidentally, what is happening here in the Catholic Church is very instructive. It's happening on a world scale. I just hope this Pope don't die. In terms of peace, in terms of the freedom movement, this Pope has made some tremendous encyclicals and statements, and the Catholic Church segments of it are mobilized to fight on these questions. There are currents and trends, reactionary and progressive, raging inside the Catholic Church today. They too reflect the trends. It was true during the period of the rise of capitalism. The church reflected the changes. The Catholic Church couldn't adjust to the changes from the monarchy to the republic, and the Protestant Church was born to carry the kind of religion that the Catholics wanted preached, that these things were not ordained by God, that man could change certain things and let them go and become capitalists. So they got a church to represent that viewpoint. It's all right if some church wants to come along now and espouse socialism as a viewpoint in order to live as a church, have no quarrel. Let them go. We'll debate the question about religion or any other thing after socialism is here. But right now, to change this, every force is needed. And so I say to you, comrades and friends, we are living in an age of change. The aftermath of the Cuban crisis has set into motion forces which I am certain are going to generate, not without struggle now, I don't want anybody to underestimate that, not without struggle, but inherent in the situation is the possibility of making some major achievements in the decade of the 60s that were not present prior to the Cuban crisis. And now we are in a position to witness a renaissance. And I say to you who have kept the faith and have maintained things this far, things are not going to change overnight. What I'm saying here is not going to be something that one morning we'll wake up and it's all changed, anything like that. We're still going to have to struggle. We're still going to have to prod. But I suggest that the soil upon which we will now be raking with our hoes will be a little better productive dirt than the dirt, the sand that we've been working in up until now. Based on some knowledge of certain things that has taken place in the Soviet Union, I think it would probably fit the same pattern. The CIA, that is the intelligence arm of the American government, is extremely active among the Africans who go to the socialist country to school for the purpose of blowing up some incidents in order to counteract the constant bombardment that the peoples of Europe are getting in respect to the Negro question in the United States. So I would think that the CIA is very busy in this regard. However, I have an impression that the Bulgarian comrades did not handle this situation correctly. I'm of the opinion that they played into the hands of the CIA. I cannot conceive of them throwing these kids in jail. Even if they had problems, they could have found other ways and means of handling the group that became troublemakers in the situation. So without knowing any more, that's my general impression. I think they've made a mistake, and I think they'll have to be told. Chinese comrades are saying that they can march on to socialism without the Soviet Union or the other socialist countries. They can pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. And so they seem to be very adamant in the positions that they've taken. And each time there's an effort made to try to see what can be done to reconcile differences and so forth, they raise the ante and make impossible conditions and so forth. It may well be we have to face the fact there will be a split in the World Communist Movement for an indefinite period of time. Meanwhile, what I'll probably be able to do is affect unity on specific things that they can agree on while disagreeing on others. This may have to be a method. What will bring about an internal change in the Chinese Communist Party, I don't know. There was a situation in the Russian Communist Party, and death had provided a means of correcting many of the errors that had been made in the Russian Party. I would like to suggest that death would be the cure for the Chinese Party, but something internally is going to have to happen. And it may well be the internal situation. Chinese leadership has made a number of internal mistakes. Somebody was just mentioning here this business of steel mills in the backyards, as well as the communes. And they've had to readjust a number of these things. Conceivably that if they make enough mistakes and so forth, the people in China may assert themselves and affect a change in the leadership of the Chinese Party. But that's the only way I see a change is going to take place now. There have to be some changes inside the Communist Party there.
Don't you think that if they were headed into the UN, that would make all the difference in the world in their internal and their foreign politics?
It would certainly make a difference in the sense that they wouldn't be isolated. But let me tell you that the Chinese Communists have made it very difficult to get admitted into the United Nations. There's no reason why the Chinese Communists shouldn't be in the UN right now on the basis of the relationship of forces. The vote that they could have probably mustered declined in the last vote that took place after they invaded India. Now, India has been one of those neutrals that have been fighting for their admission into the UN. And this alienated some of the forces there. Now, in addition to this, the Chinese Communists put them in an impossible, almost impossible condition. They say they will never come into the UN until, Chiang Kai-shek get the hell out of there. In other words, it's not both being in there who will come in and use this as a base and then fight Chiang Kai-shek from that forum. We are not coming in and dirty our hands as long as these people are sitting in. Well, this is stupid politics in my opinion. Far be it from me to try to be holier than thou and speak about a party that has led a quarter of humanity to freedom. But I think we've found that even the most ordinary among us can sometimes be right when world statesmen are wrong. Are there any other questions?
In the labor movement here, Ruther, Atha, the prolonged strikes that were made, I don't know how to ask the question, but I'd like to hear a couple of comments on how it
I think that there are a couple of things that are currently present in the labor movement that was not present several years ago, reflecting also this question I raised about the age of change. First and foremost is the fact that the AFL-CIO, for the first time, is committed to wage a struggle for a shorter work week. That's the 30 for 40. And in pursuance of this goal, has already taken a position independent of the Kennedy administration, which poo-poos in a shorter work week. I think that that problem of automation, which I spoke about earlier, is of itself a compelling influence upon this labor movement to begin to think in the militant terms of the 30s and the 40s and the 60s. Whereas in the 50s, we know how complacent labor was. The second feature is the fact of organizing the unorganized. The IUD, that is the Industrial Union Department of the FFL-CIO is presently engaged in a gigantic organizing drive, which can have a tremendous effect on the political situation in the country, especially as it relates to the South. For some of you who will not be present, perhaps tomorrow night, I will take this few minutes to raise one of the questions that I shall discuss tomorrow night. Namely, I'm asking the question, is it possible that in the next 9 years, the rate of progress that Negro America will make in battering down the walls of Jim Crow, will it be as slow as it were in the last 9 years? And I'm using the period of the United States Supreme Court desegregation order in 1954. 54 to 63 is 9 years. 9 years have passed, and on the basis of the rate of progress that has been made in respect to desegregating the schools of the South, projecting the 6% of school students who have been integrated, it would take us 100 years to achieve what the Supreme Court called with all deliberate speed. 100 years. And in this pamphlet here, I've made the point, and I've examined several instances, and in each one of them, it would take 100 years. So in other words, the Negro is still half free at this 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. He's still 100 years away from freedom if the pace that we are presently going on is maintained. So the question arises, will the next 9 years be as slow? And I've taken the position it will not be as slow. That it'll be faster. That in the next 9 years we can expect, with the proper struggle and so forth, a major breakthrough. And why do I put so much confidence in this particular perspective? I do it because labor, in this spirit, is facing now certain problems that it'll have to come to grips with that it was unwilling to face 9 years ago. Namely, the organization of the unorganized in the South. You see. Now, there is a movement in the South today by the King Movement to register the Negro voters. The goal is to have 2 million voters by 1964. Already, the Negro vote is the balance of power in a number of southern states and is retiring Dixiecrats from office. If you get an organized labor movement in the South, working in conjunction with this movement, bringing the poor whites to the polls and voting anti-Dixiecrat, the South will be transformed, the Dixiecrats will go, and new representatives will come into the halls of Congress representing liberal doctrines, and even some of the Dixiecrats, sensing the change in the times and so forth, will be like, you know, Johnson of Texas, running around down there with this Hindu who is darker than I am, sleeping in the same room with him all over Texas, campaigning in San Antonio for a Mexican against a white man for a particular office and so forth. Johnson didn't do these things before. He changed. And some of the Dixiecrats under that kind of impact will change. So that I see this labor movement in a different posture in the next period of time than was the case here before. Are there any other questions?
McCarran, next.
White middle class community and students are more forthright in speaking up on some of these questions than in the labor movement. But as I said before, as labor learns to struggle from the new way, it will struggle on these fronts too. And this gap, I think, will be closed. At the present moment, I can name too much motion inside the labor movement on the Karen Act. However,
struggle and the peace struggle, that's different. Something's happening. Something new is developing. The UAWLA seminar sometime at the UN a few weeks ago, perhaps some of you read about that. Some of the speeches made that were really significant, especially by Mavic. And there are peace conferences taking place in various parts of the country, organized and led by trade unions, which was not the case hitherto. So there's much to hope for there. But it'll take a little struggle. And it tends to take this church movement and beat the labor movement into an approach on civil rights. Or to use it can be otherwise, because the Catholics are making a big pitch, and they represent a certain trend in the religion. And I think they ought to be a factor in helping to getting place then.
Of the what?
The Gauntlet in Canada in relation to
did you hear Kennedy when he spoke on the State of the Union? And he spoke about the slogan of Karl Marx, said that capitalism provides its own grave. Because, or what was it now, the seeds of its own disintegration. And he spoke about the communist world, communist movement being in disarray. By the way, that word disarray, hardly heard of it before. Now everybody parrots it. Everybody. President said it. Everybody used it. Just like Jacqueline had to, you know, that becomes this is a smart family. I got the thought. Thinking about Jacqueline, made me think of the thought. What is Jeff?
Oh, Canada.
Well, I think that what's happening in Canada is, I'm sure Kennedy wish he had waited for he spoke about the seeds of disintegration. So no sooner than the words were out in relation to the communist world, than NATO fell apart with Dieffendorf and Adenauer, and now Dieffendorf in Canada. American policy is becoming bankrupt. American leadership of the capitalist world isn't what it was 5 years ago. In other words, nations are beginning to shift for themselves and to defend their own interests. During this period of American leadership and domination of the capitalist world, American policy was all it counted. Many times, nations had to take American policy and carry it out because they were economic pawns of American imperialism. Take in France during the Marshall Plan days. What did they do? They made the Frenchmen stop drinking so much wine and drink Coca-Cola. See? And they have done a lot of things like this to these countries. Now, Canada don't want to be a target in the Cold War and if the hot war develops. You know, and if they go placing atomic warheads and all that stuff over there, some of these Canadians say, well, look, we want to sit this out. They don't fight. Let them go. But if we got all these weaponry, all this weaponry over here, they'll be coming over here too. The same thing Africans are saying. They want Africa isolated from the rest of this world, so to speak, right now. Because if Europe wants to destroy the United States, and vice versa, and so forth, maybe Nkrumah has the same thing as Mai Mayo has. We're going to reorganize the world under black leadership. I'm just being facetious about a very serious subject, but there are elements of truth in that. It'd be very interesting what happens with the election. Thank you. Soviet Union had some arrangements with India, which included MiGs, for a long time. Contractual relationships. And I think you are correct in honoring those. I don't think that the Soviet Union ought to allow the Chinese to determine whether they will be friendly with India or not on the basis of what I would call stupid politics in that little real estate up there on top of that mountain, which doesn't mean to a hill of beans compared to the unity of India and China in today's world in facing imperialism. And so I think the Soviet Union is not allowing what is happening between India and China to disrupt a friendly relationship that they've established already. You go into that in a deeper sense, my opinion is that the Marxist movement in India has been set back as a result of that invasion. The Communist Party of India has been split to pieces practically. And Chrisman Menon, who represented very advanced thinking in India, was heir, political heir, Nehru. Probably next to Nehru, the most influential figure in India. The reactionaries in India have taken full advantage of this situation and have just about diminished it. Nehru himself has become a prisoner of the most reactionary elements inside China, inside India. Often carrying out policies that perhaps he might not be in agreement with. But it's very difficult when your so-called enemy is sitting right on your soil and you're talking about taking it easy. Above all, Nehru's role in the world, independent of the fact that he is a very poor type socialist, put it mildly. But his role in affecting world peace has been seriously damaged. Because he was the moral force in the world that constantly was moralizing American and British imperialism. He stood on a high moral platitude and was able to look at them without sin, to tell them how sinful they are. And armaments and pure power politics and all these corruptions and so forth that they engage in. And now they look at Nehru and they say, you have to come to us to get some of those bullets now that you tell us we didn't need to manufacture. So the cold facts of life have caught up with you. The Chinese got you. So this doesn't help. And for God's sake, for what? For what? 30 or 40 little square miles is being contested as to who owned what. Not in a big valley where there's agricultural possibilities or big industries is concentrated there, and if you get the industry, it'll make a decisive difference or something. No. Dignity, conceit, arrogance, and yet they talk about signification of Marxism. They talk about chauvinism and imperialism and are displaying chauvinism in respect to the Indian people. I get worked up when I think about something. So let's get another question. Well, there are three major currents in the Negro liberation movement today. One current which calls for integration. That is reflected by all the major organizations in Negro life. Although there are variations within them as to how to achieve integration. Some for using most mass techniques, mass struggle techniques, and some for more just legal, like the NAACP hierarchy, although they're changing too. Well, that's one current, and it's the dominant current. Then you have the Williams current in South Carolina, or North Carolina. Although Williams is in Cuba, the ideology that he expounded finds some fertile soil to work upon. Let me give you an illustration. There was a student that came up from one of the colleges in the state of Arkansas to interview me recently. He had read about Claude Lightfoot and so forth and so on. And he got a few days off the side to come to Chicago to have a talk with me. And he asked me, what did I think about the struggles in the South? And I went on to tell him what I thought about King's splendid leadership. Notwithstanding criticism we may have of him and certain ideological weaknesses and so forth, nonetheless, politically, struggle-wise, tactics and strategy and so forth, in full agreement. Guy looks at me, he says, you know what? I said, what? You're not the Claude Lightfoot I've been reading about. The Claude Lightfoot I've been reading about is a revolutionary. You ain't nothing but a fat Castro. I mentioned this because he's not typical of the Southern students, but he is typical of a growing frustration among even students who participated yesterday in the sit-in, come back and ask themselves, where have we gotten? See, these methods are not a winning method. We better do something more drastic. And we have to take up arms if necessary to win this battle. And here this revisionist Life would come along talking about Father King. Why, he thought he was going to hear from me all about what they said in the courtroom, overthrow the government forces, violence, and everything else, you know. Well, he didn't get it. Now, there is another movement that is growing. It represents a different current from all these others because they are not pro-integration, they are pro-separation. Black Muslims. And the Black Muslims is the fastest growing organization in America today. They have a newspaper. Just to give you an illustration, a few years ago they poured a lot of money into papers like the Pittsburgh Courier and out in Los Angeles, the Herald Dispatch. And they used to speak. Muhammad had a column, Muhammad Speaks. Now they organize their own newspaper. And they didn't have enough black Muslims with newspaper skills, so they went out and employed some talented newspaper men. Better, like, you know, Dick Durham, who used to be a writer on the Chicago Defender. He's their editor. Or a person like Charlie Howard. Some of you probably remember Howard from Iowa, who keynoted the Progressive Party Convention back in 1948, a lawyer. Well, he is their foreign correspondent in the UN. And this is the best Negro newspaper in the country. You know what the circulation is? 400,000. And this is more than the Chicago Defender, the Baltimore Afro-American, the Pittsburgh Courier, and the New York Amsterdam put together. Their members hawk those newspapers into the barbershops, pool rooms, on the street corners, like newspaper boys. They do
what the communist movement has been calling on in regards to the worker for a good many years. I have never seen such a disciplined, dedicated group of people as is in the membership of the Black Muslim Organization. And it is a serious force, a serious force. They represent, however, the frustration that many Negroes feel in terms of this token integration that we're getting. They are representing an extremist view of the hell with the whole works. If we don't, why should we integrate with you? You on your way out anyway. That's the argument they make. You laugh. And a lot of others laugh. And others do something about it. They join them. Well, anyway, they are a very serious movement, and my opinion is that they can be contained. They can be contained to the extent that we make a breakthrough on Jim Crow. You know, I got into arguments with these Muslims out in Washington Park Forum, where I was once everything we said went out there. The Muslims moved out there. I hadn't been around for a year or two. I went out there and I made a speech. These young Muslims jumped up and grabbed me, had me sweating, and I couldn't get away from them, you know. I was living in the 30s. I was talking about Negro-white unity, and I was talking about the birth of CI. I was talking about what we've done to affect the things are so much better than the day when I came along in the 30s when I was your age. I didn't get nowhere. I went off somewhere and thought about this. How come I'm isolated out there? And I went back out there again, and I didn't see enough to move. I come out of the 30s into the 60s, not in living back in the past, and understanding what's up to what's in their mind. They want it now. They don't want no gradualism here, 15, 20 years so. They want it now. They have no confidence they can get it now from whites, so they say, separate. Well, all right, how can I best fight a Muslim? I can fight him when I can go to the park and say that white Americans will fight for your rights. And here is a demonstration of it over here, where some people did such and such a thing. Here's another demonstration over there, and get enough arguments to refute them. But in the absence of that, you standing out there talking about Negro-white unity, and you can't show good examples of where they really fought and went on through a sufficient, you know, numbers and all that and so forth, they'll beat you to death every day. So the answer to the Muslims, comrades, is what we do to affect the struggle against Jim Crow. That's one thing. And the second one is that those who, Negroes who are progressive, learn how to get inside the Muslim movement and direct it a little differently. Give it a different direction. By the way, I am told that Muhammad was very much impressed with an article I wrote on the Muslim movement. Now, I said it advisedly because when I was writing the article, my wife, a very sick woman, and I gave her the article to read at the end of it, and she told me, she says, Claude, she says, if I were Muhammad, she says, I'd order 15,000 copies of that article and have it distributed. What? So I had to go back and look that article over to see what was wrong with it, and I had to make some changes in it. And but anyway, what I'm told that impressed him most was it wasn't a name-calling affair. It was an attempt to analyze him objectively and to even give him an argument or two as to how he can achieve what he wants. My argument with him was not separation per se. I told him you can't achieve a separate Negro nothing until you change that man down in Washington who's there now. In order to do that, you need all the American people, white, black, and everybody else to do that. And then if you get more favorable, liberal-minded people down there, they'll say, all right, if that's just what you people want, go on over there and get your little state and set it up. That's it. That's the only way you'll ever get it, if people will want it. So, I don't know, I'm told that Malcolm X was favorable too, although they called me recently from Drake University, that Des Moines, Iowa, to come down there sometime in February
the debate with Malcolm X. I found out later on that Malcolm X felt that he didn't want to debate with me because that was too divisive. That what these white people wanted to do down here at this university was get these two Negroes fighting among themselves. So Malcolm X doesn't show up. I was ready to go. And I don't think it would have been divisive either. What I mean in terms of divisiveness as far as Negroes are concerned. But argument on his policy and policy that will lead to freedom is two different things. Malcolm X can't get up and say things because he's a Negro and expect nobody will challenge him because some white people may be sitting in the audience somewhere. I heard him say over TV, by the way, some of these arguments are the same as you hear from the white supremacists. Every Negro who wants integration wants to marry your daughter. I hear that come from the lips of a Negro. Is there something else? Okay, any other questions? Okay, I've had the flu.